Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Poetically Yours Extended podcast. I'm Yvonne Booz. This podcast is an extension of WNIJ's Poetically Yours weekly segment. Today's guest is Richard Vargas. Vargas's Rockford-inspired collection of poems, The Screw City Poems, was released on July 11th. In this episode, he talks about his writing style, his early years in Compton, California, and what led him to Rockford. Take a listen. Thank you for joining this Poetically Yours Extended podcast. And I want to start off by talking about your early years in Compton, California, and what your first piece of work was about.
Well, I was born in Compton a long time ago, and things were a bit different back then. I remember, visiting my grandmother and riding the rail car to go to the movies, and going across the railroad tracks to get a bag of penny candy and buy a comic book. There's a lot of great memories there from childhood, but there's also some angst and some bad memories as well. That's where my father developed a drug problem. He was a heroin addict, and he actually died when I was 10 of an overdose. So there's good and bad, as with all of us, wherever we grow up. So I associate with being from Compton and having experienced a lot of childhood memories there. My first piece that I ever wrote was in junior high. It was going into the eighth grade, and that's kind of when everything started to bloom for me from a poetry standpoint. Even though I really didn't know what I was doing, I knew that I enjoyed reading whatever poetry I could get my hands on when I was that age. So my first poem was about a soldier who was dying in Vietnam, and I compared his death to a candle that was slowly, burning to the bottom and then was snuffed out.
Before that, had you ever read poetry?
When I was a ferocious reader as a kid, read anything and everything I could get my hands on. So when I would go into the beginning of a new school year, they would always hand us out that anthology that we would be reading from throughout the year. Well, the first thing I would do is skim through it and look for all the poems, because they were short. I could read them, in one take. And that's kind of where I started getting this interest. I could read, there was a lot of rhyme. And I didn't know that you could go beyond that. I thought it had to rhyme to be a poem. But I also was interested in the music of the language and the rhythm that was in a lot of the early stuff that I was reading at that time. I always wanted to be a singer or a musician, and I have no musical talent whatsoever. But this was kind of a way of being able to hook into that, only from a different angle. And so I felt like poetry gave me a voice.
I can so relate to that as a poet. I remember thinking I could sing. And, back in the, we always don't want to age ourselves. But back in the day, we had the cassette player. So I had a little cassette player and I would record myself. And I remember saying, "Who is that?" And then that's when I was like, "Okay, this is not for you." And I would wonder why my aunt and uncle would always laugh when I would sing along to the radio. I'm like, "What's so funny? Like, this is my jam." And they were laughing. That's because I wasn't musically inclined like that. So I definitely relate to that right there. When I read the book, it was like going through an adventure. I love the fact that you talk about anything. And there were times I was like, "Oh, he said it. Okay, he said that." Where did that come from? Just that freedom in your writing.
When I got into, first of all, I was seeking guidance in the way of contemporary poetry as to what was being written then. I wanted to know, and nobody in the schools could give me an answer. My English teachers had no clue. So I was very frustrated. I was just looking on my own. So then as an undergrad in college, where I was able to finally start to study it, and I had, instructors who were able to recommend and point me in the right direction. I began to realize that poetry is everywhere and in everything. And for me, the eye opener was were the works of Charles Bukowski. He was writing about everything, you know, going to the track and betting, listening to classical music on the radio, you know, getting in a fight with his girlfriend and getting, you know, whatever. It was all there. And I realized I didn't have to write like the poetry I was reading in the American Poetry Review or in Poetry Magazine, because in order to get published there, I realized I was going to have to change my voice, my style, and plus there were very little or no Latino poets getting published in those publications. Bukowski made me realize I didn't have to change anything. I could write about whatever I wanted and I could make it a poem.
And that you do. Now, I want to talk about the time that you had literary magazines that you were publishing other works. Where did that come from? Why did you want to do that?
And again, the first time I did it was as an undergrad, during a period of independent study. My advisor, gave me the okay, the green light. And that was because at that time, that's what everybody was doing. Everybody was publishing their own little magazine. It was okay, there was the mimeograph revolution where people were just doing it on mimeograph and stapling pages together. And then we finally advanced it a little bit to like more of a poetry, journal type format, almost like a chapbook. And so I wanted to do that. I felt a need to be able to present a venue or a platform for poets who were a published and well known, as well as voices that no one had ever heard before. I felt the emphasis was shouldn't be on the personality or the stature of the poet. It's always the emphasis on the poem. That's why I say a lot, it's all about the poem. You can write, send me, you know, links to 1,000 poems, and I may not like any of them. But if you have one in there, one poem, I'll take it. But it's about the poem, and I'm not going to judge it by the rest of the work that you sent me.
Oh, that's cool. I've never heard it put that way before. Now, I also saw something where you said that when you moved to Rockford, it pushed you into writing again. Tell me about that 15-year break that you had. That just sounds horrible when I think about it. I know that I struggle sometimes to write creatively, especially since I'm writing for work. But 15 years going by and you don't create a poem. You have to explain how that felt. I think I would have felt like I lost the craft.
It was very frustrating. You know, right out of college, I'd been published in some really, we considered prestigious small press magazines. One in particular, the Wormwood Review, you know, had published a lot of poets of stature, and he'd actually published me a couple of times. So I knew I had it. And then I had my one and only ever DUI, and I had to spend the night in jail, and it woke me up, and I thought, I need to get out of California. And I figured if I joined the military, I'd get all this material and I could keep on writing. Well, I joined the military, I left California, and I couldn't get back to it. It was weird. Then I got married. The woman I met while I was in the military was from Rockford. And so then I got caught up in married life. I got out of the military, went back to California. I was living this different life. I was in a different place. But I always knew that I could write because I'd been published. I knew I had it. And it was frustrating. I would, you know, as a driver for UPS during my lunch, I would just sit there and think about how am I going to get back to this, to my writing? And it finally came back when I moved to Rockford in 1995. For some reason, it gave me permission to be who I wanted to be, who I was always meant to be. I didn't have to live up to anybody's standards or expectations. I could be anybody I wanted to be. And I went back to being a writer.
I want to circle back when you talked about getting the DUI and you had to learn a lesson. What was going on in your life around that time that you made that particular decision to drive while under the influence?
I had met a friend, another poet friend who was in town for the weekend, who was also had a small press publishing operation. And so we knew each other very well, and we'd been in touch before. And it was just a stupid night where we were just bar hopping, bar to bar to bar, walking the street, you know. And by the end of the night, it's like, okay, man, see you later. And we got in our cars, and he had somebody waiting for him to drive him away. I got in my car. Very stupid. I've never done that again. But it made me realize that, okay, I'm publishing my little magazine. I'm writing, smoking a lot of pot. And then I was like cracking open my first beer at 10 o'clock in the morning. And it just made me realize, dude, you're not going to make it if you stay like this. It just wasn't going to be a good thing for me. So I knew I had to get out of California for a while.
Oh wow. And California, you think about it and you think about, oh, that sounds like the life. The weather, everything that's going on in that state, and then to come to a smaller town and then your creative juices start to flow again. That's very interesting. So I'm gonna start talking about the book. We know the book is coming out in July, but I had the opportunity to get a preview of it, and I want to talk about some of the things. I took some notes down, and your style of writing, and a couple of things that jumped out to me, and there were a lot, so I don't know if we'll get through all this, but it was the particular poem where you were talking about working as a call center agent for an insurance company and how you got the phone call and the way you were able to transition from that place to saying you wanted to go find that sterile room with white walls where faceless people were. And I may not, I'm reading my handwriting, so I may not be reading it correctly based on what you said, because I feel like I'm missing a word. But to jump in and out of a scene, I don't know if I've seen that so much in poetry. Where did that concept for you come from? Where you're on the phone talking, and then you're saying, I need to go tell these people that they're gonna too have to go through this some point, because we all have to leave this earth.
Well, that's the beauty about poetry is you can make that leap and make that connection all like on a page or two, which is one of the reasons I've enjoyed doing it all this time. Besides Charles Bukowski, another one of my early influences was the poet Edward Field. Edward Field introduced me to narrative poetry. He also made me realize it was okay to let the reader know how you were feeling. Back in the day, it was like that was a no-go. You weren't supposed to, poetry wasn't about feeling. Well, it is, and it's a way of sharing and connecting with the reader, because then you realize, hey, I felt that before as well. So it's a good thing, I think. So I can take an instant like that, and then based on my personal experience as a call center rep for a medical insurance company, express my frustration and the empathy I have for the caller, but how I really am almost powerless to be able to take care of the situation that they're calling about. So there's empathy and there's a feeling of power, having no power to resolve the problem for the fellow human being. Yeah, that poem was read by Garrison Keillor on a Poet's Almanac, Writer's Almanac back in the day.
Now, that's another thing you and I have in common. I worked for a call center for many years, and I think I did start writing about the job later on, but as far as the call center experience and talking to the customers, I never even thought about putting that in my creative works. But that's an inspiration to hear that. Now I have to go back in my mind and think, what were some of those tough calls that I think people would relate to or could relate to? So,
Yeah, it's the poetry of work, and there's poetry in work.
yeah, so your work puts out a different type of inspiration, that writing about everything. So I was so glad to read, and I was able to get done with it in 2 days. I started yesterday afternoon, took a break, and then picked it up this morning before our interview. And there is another line that I wanted to talk about that really jumped out to me. I thought it was well put together. You said, you tasted pretty good poetry, felt it pour out of from your fingertips. So that line just, oh my goodness, I get it. And then when it's, you said pour from your fingertips, I think about the writing and it coming from the page. I love the way you put that. What type of feeling do you get when you write those types of lines? Because I know when I write something that I think is profound, it just gives me a high in a sense. How about you? How do you feel when you write things and you put it in such a way that it's like, man, that was good? Or let me look that up. Did I write that or did I hear that somewhere? Because that was too good.
Yeah, for me, it's about the image that I'm trying to put into your head, as the reader. I don't want so much, there's telling about the poem, and that's okay to an extent, but I really want to show you the poem. So I've got to create images that I think are going to stick and hit the reader right between the eyes. And sometimes I do it, and sometimes I miss, but I'm really not aware of it while I'm doing it. It's kind of like it's just flowing through me. And the weird thing about what I'm doing, even right now as we're talking, to kind of promote my book, is as an artist, we self-promotion doesn't come easy. It's not something we like to do to the extent where we let it take over. It's we, and I feel weird sometimes because I feel like I'm projecting this big ego to the public. And actually, I feel like my best work is when I push my ego aside and I just let it flow through me. I've developed this very new agey spiritual conception of art. And I think it's an entity unto itself, and that it existed long before we were around. And we're being picked, chosen, and used to expand the art in our universe, in our reality. And so we're like a tool of what we love to do. But yeah, at the same time, though, when it gets recognition, it's read on the radio, we're talking about it because you really liked it. That also makes me feel good as well. So it's a struggle. It's a fine line that we have to walk.
All right, so I'm going to take a moment and have you read something for our audience.
Sure. That'd be great. I'll read the one that you brought up, which was written when I was a call center agent for Conseco Medical Insurance. Back in the 90s, they were downtown in that big tall building across from the Coronado. And that was my introduction to call center work. So this poem is called It's a Living. It's called customer service, trying to help my fellow man make sense of the medical insurance some slick carpet-bagging agent talked him into buying. There are no easy answers. Like today, the guy on the phone was speaking with restraint, holding on to his dignity. But I know begging when I hear it. His voice cracked as he told me the doctor tending to his dying wife was getting phone calls from one of our case managers, being pressured to get her released from the hospital. Please, he said, please ask them to stop. She's in so much pain. My wife, my best friend, she's in a lot of pain, and there's nothing they can do. Please stop the phone calls. I tell him he's got us mixed up with someone else. There is no record of any phone calls in his wife's file. But I know better. I want to put him on hold, go find the sterile room with white walls where faceless people hold jelly donuts gripped tight in their pudgy hands as they put dollar signs on the way we die. I want to stick my head inside, remind them that sooner or later, we all finish the race. Sometimes it ain't too pretty, but in the end, if we're lucky, we'll have the love of a precious few, maybe the ability to stare death in the eye. So let this one go. Just leave her be. But instead, I assure the guy I'll do my best to find out what's going on, wait for him to hang up, decide to take my break 10 minutes early. Times like this, I wish I had taken up smoking.
There you go. The poems that people don't even think about, but it resonates because I'm sure we all have been in situations where we may have had to, in a work environment, where we may have had to give some news or even listen to someone, and we really could only help them so much. You know, there's only so much we can do. I want to take a moment and talk about just your journey in life. We were talking about you being in Compton and then going to the armed forces. Give me a picture of how that looked for you during that time when you were in the armed forces. How did that inspire your work?
Well, what happened is, even though I wasn't writing at that time, I acquired a ton of experiences. So when I did finally start writing, those poems started to come. So that was the good thing. The military was interesting. I found out a lot of things about myself that I wouldn't have found out otherwise. Learning how to work with people from all over the country with different backgrounds and beliefs and, you know, different ways to conduct themselves and having to come together to complete the mission. So that was very interesting. I was introduced to levels of misogyny and racism that I hadn't really seen, you know, in my little condensed universe in California. I mean, I knew it was there, but in the Army, you really, it's, you see it and it's like, whoa. So that was an eye opener for me as well. And I did write a series of Army poems, which is in one of my earlier books.
How many books have you published?
Well, this will be the sixth book. I've been pretty active since 2000. No, since 2021, during COVID, I organized a book that was published in 2022. And then in 2023, I had a second book published. And now this one. So I've had six all in total.
What was that like publishing your first book? And why did you decide to publish?
Well, my first book, it was interesting. I mean, I was close to 50, turning 50 when I finally had my first book published. And it was frustrating because I knew I was good enough to be published, but I was getting rejected left and right. Very frustrating. That's, you know, if you've ever sent your work out in manuscript form, you might be able to relate. So I was getting to the point where I thought, man, am I going to have to self-publish? I don't want to self-publish. That's like, you know, taking the final chill pill. And I was like, no, I don't want to do that. And then while I was living in Albuquerque, New Mexico, a guy out of North Carolina was publishing some of my poems in his poetry magazine. And he said, "Hey, do you have enough for a book?" And I said, "Yeah." One thing led to another. Next thing I know, he's accepting it to publish it. I was overwhelmed. I mean, that first time you get a case of your books and you're actually holding one in your hands, oh man, that's heaven. Yeah, and even now, when I get a case of a book that's just being published and you hold it, it's a really, really good feeling.
Yeah, you have a lot of life experiences. Now, I want to go back to Rockford, being in that place and writing more. How did you connect with the community there as far as other writers?
So as soon as I got there, I found myself in a writing group that was meeting once a week at the Ethnic Heritage Museum over by South Main. And so that's where I was, reading and some of my new work that I was just beginning to write and getting really positive feedback and comments. And then this group, decided to give some readings around town, and we were doing that. And eventually, I found myself at Cafe Esperanto, which is Portman's downtown. But at the time, upstairs, they had this venue called Cafe Esperanto. They had a bar and tables, and they'd have some really great poetry readings there. For that day in Rockford, that was like the place to go for good poetry. And so I was at one where I met Dennis Gulling, who's a Rockford poet who has a long history in the small press poetry scene. Frank Shear, who was the editor of the Rock River Times, was the host of this particular reading. So then I was introduced to him. We kind of became really well acquainted. He eventually asked me to be the poetry editor for the Rock River Times. And it was actually much more than that, but that was my title. And so then people were reading what I was writing, my column. I was promoting poetry wherever it was being held in the town. Then I got the job as the community events coordinator for Barnes and Noble when it was on East State. And everything took off then, because now I was able to set up readings, have writing workshops. I was reaching out to Chicago and bringing authors into town. I contacted Mark Smith, the founder of Slam Poetry, and he paid his first visit to Rockford at my invite. So there was a whole scene going on, and I felt like I was like right in the middle of it, mixing it all up. So it was fun. I had a good time.
Now I'm going to take a moment to have you read something else from your book.
Sure. And this one, I think is still relevant, even though it happens in Chicago. In the winter of 1999, I believe, the Art Institute had an exhibit of Van Gogh and Gauguin's art, a beautiful show, huge show. And I went to go see it, and this poem came out of it. It's called Van Gogh's Ear. Found it in the gutter downtown Chicago, picked it up, put it in my pocket. Now it goes everywhere I go, never leave home without it. The FBI found out, invited me to a mandatory interview. They consider Vincent subversive, a terrorist of art, but a terrorist just the same. They gave me crayons, blank paper, told me to draw something. I colored red, white, and blue planes dropping bombs and food on poor people. They were convinced I was A-OK. Today, I held it close to my own ear, wanted to hear what it hears. I listened for a long time. The silence almost drove me crazy.
Wow, I love that.
I've read that he cut it off on December 23rd. And that's my birthday. So
Oh,
that
wow.
was another connection I had there.
But tell me about some of the art that you have surrounding you and how that inspires your work.
Well, the woman holding the rifle with a bayonet, that's actually an album cover, Best of Classic Four. So I'm a big collector of vinyl as well as, poetry books and books in general. I've always picked the artwork for all of my books. And in this case, with the Screw City Poems, the photograph, the cover art was provided by a friend, Mark Bond, who lives in Rockford. He's a musician, a teacher, as well as a photographer. And he actually took that. That was a reflection off the glass window at the Irish Rose downtown. So I've always felt like I wanted to play a role in whatever was on the cover of my books. But I love art. And as you can see on my shirt here, I'm wearing Guernica. So Picasso, Van Gogh, music, I just feel like that's the lifeblood of who we are. And I think people who block it out or don't pay attention are denying a very important part of themselves.
Now, how often do you come back to Rockford? Because I know you're currently in Wisconsin.
Right. I live right just east of Madison in Monona. I always say I live close to the lake where Otis Redding's plane crashed because it crashed in Lake Monona. I go to Rockford probably once a month, maybe once every 2 months to visit friends and hang out. I will be there on July 19th. I'm having a book release party. It's at a small studio slash gallery. So I've only invited maybe 20 or 30 friends. And I'm sure the gallery owner is going to invite some people as well. So it's going to be small and private. And then on July 26, I'll be reading at it's a bookstore in Rockton, Inkwell Books and Threads. So I'll be reading there, and that's like the following weekend for my opener, my book release party in Rockford.
That's pretty cool. Now, is there anything else you want to read from the book?
So I mentioned the Irish Rose. When I was there, it was kind of the place to hang out. I'd run into somebody I knew there almost every time I walked in. And it had a really nice atmosphere and kind of weird. It's like a lot of different things were going on at once. But my best friend, who she and her husband are really good friends of mine to this very day, was a waitress at the Irish Rose. So I'd like to read this poem. It's titled For Emily, My Waitress at the Irish Rose. Who floats through the room soft as a cloud of smoke from a French cigarette, juggles glasses of house Merlot with mystical grace. This bad girl angel in leather studded collar comes to me in fishnet dreams, gives me glimpses of billowy cleavage while she hovers over my table. Her red chili pepper lips glisten in the soft light of the room as recorded jazz starts her round hips to slowly shift left, then roll right. The wiggle in her walk makes me forget what I'm supposed to be eating. Then she comes close, leans down, her sultry voice whispering in my ear, tip me, tip me big. I'm a ruined man as my wallet spreads open quicker and wider than the parting of the Red Sea.
That is a beautiful example of how you said you make sure when you're writing, and I know that's something that is taught with creative writing to show and not tell. Like you showed every sentence that you put on the page was taking me to that particular location. Like I can see her. You talked about the lips and the fishnets. It's like I can imagine her in my mind walking around with her apron. So you do a very good job at that.
Thank
I
you.
love that. I love that. And I have to say, I know earlier we were talking about how you write with such freedom, but also the comedy in your writing. Where did that come from? Because I sit and I was reading and I'm giggling and I'm like, and I'm like sighing, like, oh my God, he said that. But at the same time, I'm laughing at stuff.
That style goes back to my very early days as an undergrad at Cal State Long Beach, California University, Cal State University, Long Beach. One of my biggest mentors was Gerald Loughlin, a poet who has published extensively through Small Press. And he had that humor and that irony in his work. Another writer who was also in LA was the great is the great Ron Kirchee. Ron Kirchee was his poems are hilarious. I mean, he is so funny. And these guys made us realize you don't always have to be this serious, you could like it'd be like telling a joke. It'd be like being doing a stand-up comedian comedy routine. And so you began to write things, and as you would read them, if you heard the audience like laugh or snicker, like at right at the right time when you wanted them to, you knew you had nailed it. Edward Field, who I mentioned earlier, was another poet who made it us realize it was okay to inject humor in our work. So I always feel like the last poem I read should leave the audience laughing. I'd rather leave them laughing than, in a downer.
I love being able to read a poem and then getting my spirits lifted because now it's funny. I forgot about if I was having a bad day. Even as a writer, I try not to write when I'm going through a tough time. I know that it's a great way to express yourself, and I know that people need to hear this type of poetry sometimes, but not the whole collection. You want to take people on a journey. You don't want them to be stuck in this mundane type of situation where now they're feeling bad after reading your works. So I love that you sprinkle that comedy in there. Now, can you tell me what's next for you? You've published six books. This one's coming out and you're going to be promoting it. Do you have any other collections that you have in mind that you're thinking of?
Excuse me. Well, right now I'm focused on the book because it's coming out. I've got readings throughout this month and in August, some as far into the future as September and October. So that's my main focus. However, the other day I did sit down and start getting all the poems that I've written that have been published within the last couple of years in various magazines or online or print. And I realize I'm slowly building up to another book. So I'm excited about that. Maybe in a year or two I'll have enough for another book. And then I'll be out there again.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, before I let you go, Richard, I want to have you read one more poem for the book because I know this is, especially for our listeners in Rockford. I normally have people read a couple of poems, but for you and based on what your book is about, I really want to, share more than just a couple. So I'm just scrolling through to see if something that sticks out to me that I really enjoy that I would like you to read. And then I'm going to ask you one more question about the book before I let you go back to your day. So give me one moment. Oh, this is one I liked a lot. for the woman who cuts my hair. Do you mind reading that for us?
Right. Her name was Carla. I forgot the name of the studio or the business that she worked out of. But once you find somebody that knows how to cut your hair, you stick with them. You're loyal. You don't want to give them up. So she and I kind of developed this little relationship. I'd go in and sit down, and she'd start asking me questions. Some of them were personal, and I didn't mind answering them. So, for the woman who cuts my hair, I watch in the mirror, a tiny sparrow hopping from one side of my nest to the other. She selects and snips by instinct, leaving no unruly lock unturned. Been with her for 3 years, the one relationship I haven't managed to screw up. Realizing it's a good thing to have at least one woman in my life I can trust within 2 feet of me as she holds a sharp pointed object in her hands. Almost blew it. Between appointments, I took a pair of scissors to my annoying bangs, gave myself a little trim. Our next time together, she was icy as a scorned lover, acted like she found lipstick on my collar. Her suspicions eased only when I fessed up, promised not to do it again. She cares about me too, disapproves of my alley cat lifestyle, offers unsolicited advice on behalf of her many sisters, nudges me to settle down and get soft around the edges. When I feel sorry for myself, wonder if the relationship fairy has crossed me off her list, I imagine Carla sitting in her chair, cleaning the implements of her trade, biding her time, until I walk through her door, predictable and consistent, loyal and faithful, coming back like she knew I would, coming back for more.
Wow, did you ever share this poem with
I did.
Carla?
Yeah, she loved it.
I'm sure she did. That's amazing. Now, I want to talk about one more thing in the book before we wrap up here. At the end, I got caught up in the story with Lena. Is that how you pronounce the name?
Yes.
Okay. Was that a real story or was that a prelude to something?
It's
A
kind of
prelude.
half and half. It's half and half. I call it fiction, and a lot of what I'm describing in there kind of sort of happened, but maybe I changed the people around who it happened to. Certain characters are a composite of people I knew instead of just being one individual. And it's a piece that's about, a relationship blossoming. It involves a lot of the characters and locations in Rockford at the time, although I've given them all different names. And at the same time, and I don't know about now, but at that time, it seemed like there was this presence of people who, or men basically, who had a very predatory nature about them. And I remembered watching some of it take place, and it just left a mark on me. I felt it was important to introduce that into this short. I call it a work in progress, but I doubt if I'll continue writing about anything about it. But I introduced that aspect into the storyline because it seemed like it was in a lot of places, like it was everywhere. I may have upset some people in doing that, but I don't know.
I like that because it's like it just took you away from the poetry a little bit and it showed your creative writing even with prose. So I look forward to if you ever decide to write a novel one
That's a
day.
lot. That's way too much work. And I mean, I have mixed feelings about it because I'm not sure how good it is or if it is any good. I'm sure I'll get a lot of comments about it.
Well, it kept my attention. I wanted more, so
No, good. Thank you.
I like that. I like that a lot. Now, is there anything else you think our listeners need to know about you, your work, and what you have coming up after you? I know you're promoting the book. Anything else you want to tell them about the book that I didn't ask about?
Wow. I don't know. I mean, it's, this started out as a new and selected poetry collection. A lot of poets, once they get up there in years, they do new and selected so they can put out some of their new poems, and then everything else is selected poetry from their previous books, kind of like a greatest hits. And that's what I was starting to do. And then I realized so much of what I've written revolves around the city or the people of Rockford. So this is a love-hate letter to Rockford, Illinois. It's played such an important role in my life. And I never ever would have thought that, earlier when I was younger, that one locale could have this kind of effect on me. So in many ways, it put me on the road to become who I am right now. It prepared me because when I did leave Rockford in 2002, I went to Albuquerque, New Mexico. I got my MFA in creative writing at the University of New Mexico. I met Joy Harjo. She became a good friend of mine. I met so many writers and artists in that area. My first three books were published while I was there. So I feel like Rockford, Albuquerque, that's what made me as far as the writer, the poet that I am right now. So I want to say thank you to Rockford.
Well, thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. I wish you much success.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Poetically Yours Extended Podcast. Listen to our weekly segment every Friday during Here and Now and All Things Considered on WNIJ. Special thanks to the Nick Monte Trio Band for providing the tunes for this podcast. For Poetically Yours, I'm Yvonne Booz.